I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The dawn of a new age flashed past us in the news this summer. Dateline Oregon, scientists from the U.S., China, and South Korea together had tweaked the genes of a living human embryo to correct an inherited flaw that has caused heart failure and sudden death in a lot of young athletes. And so, finally, suddenly, we enter the CRISPR age in biotechnology, when human science takes charge of the human genetic lifeline to fix it here, tune it there, perhaps retailor it in useful ways. We could be doing it soon with $100 DIY kits at home. The Chinese are doing it too. As the pioneer in the CRISPR breakthrough, Jennifer Doudna, says, we have the ability now to edit the DNA of every living person and future generations too. In essence, Doudna writes, it means the power to direct the evolution of our species. Unprecedented in the history of life on Earth, she adds, beyond our comprehension and raising impossible but essential questions for which as individuals and as a species, she says, we are woefully unprepared. The thought here is that we could be better prepared at the end of this hour with a rounded look, scientific and humanistic, at this newborn CRISPR. Did you ever want to direct evolution, to redesign mankind, or to pick your eye color, or redirect a family history of alcoholism or cancer? Here's what a few people told us on Boston Common this week.
All those things sound good. Smarter, faster, that all sounds good. I mean, almost like, you know, playing God a little bit. You know, if you believe God designed us each the way we are, then you're kind of tinkering with that a little bit.
I'd probably, like, make myself, like, a morning person.
I think I would want to be more coordinated because I'm, like, I'm really bad with, like, basketball. Like, I can't even skip rocks.
Change of the face, change the body. Is now is an industry because no one can accept itself.
Yeah, I think it's unnecessary to dwell on what you could change by someone else changing it for you. I think you should focus more on what you can change about yourself by actively taking measures.
Honestly, I've had a lot of skin problems in my life, so I think I would really like to kind of make it so that did not happen.
I guess along the same line, like everybody in my family is just like compulsively late. You know, I don't know. I don't know if there's a way to change that genetically.
Well, I think my whole family would say our predilection to being overweight, being overweight, obese, definitely. I mean, just runs in our family.
You know, I'm Asian, and the majority of us are short. So, you know, if I could add, like, maybe another inch or two, that would probably be pretty good.
We got diabetes in my family, and we also got aplastic anemia, which is a blood disorder. And those are two things that took people in my family really outside of their prime, and they could have led a long and healthful life with if either of those had been solved.
Michael Eisen in Berkeley, California, gets us started. He's a genetic biologist who works mainly on fruit flies. He's a colleague of the CRISPR pathfinder, Jennifer Doudna, on the Berkeley team in a literal contest with the MIT-Harvard team at the Broad Institute in Cambridge over patent claims on CRISPR and its applications. So, Michael, in Major League Biology, you play for the Oakland Athletics against our Red Sox, but you have also dissented eloquently online from this whole idea of patenting a public resource. You're a scientist and an insider with a critical mind. Would you boil your CRISPR story down for us?
Sure. So, you know, for 50 years or so, biologists have been imagining the day that we could look at someone's DNA, find out what's wrong with it, and fix it. This has been the goal of molecular biology, whether implicit or explicit in the hundreds of billions of dollars we've put into it. And, you know, that day has arrived. We're you know, the details of the biology and where CRISPR comes from and how it works are fascinating, but they're not really the important question here.
We're here at the moment when we can do almost anything, but must we?
Right. I mean, I think this is the question we need to ask us is, you know, do you trust humanity with the ability to control the future of our planet and every species on it? It's, you know, is there anything in our history to suggest we're up to it, that we're up to the challenge? And you know, and I guess maybe a little bit more practically, what kind of things can we do, both as, you know, scientists and as the public and governments, to try to nudge things in the right direction as we enter this kind of brave new world?
Michael, your voice just suggests to me the fundamental question. Do the scientists really believe it?
Do we believe that we can
that
do it?
Or can, that we must, that you have the power,
yeah,
that you even want the power?
We want the power. We've been seeking the power forever. I mean, this.
Well, of course, for sport, but now you've got the ball.
Not for sport. I think it's not sport. I'm a great believer in molecular biology and in science and technology in general. And you know, from basically the moment that we knew that DNA encoded, you know, life, and heredity, we have been searching for its, not just searching to understand its secrets, but figuring out how we can manipulate it for good. I mean, you know, we all write grants every year, you know, telling the government to give us money to play around with DNA because we're going to, you know, diagnose and cure diseases. And it's always been kind of a distant fantasy in many ways.
Right, but the grant writing and all that, I call it sport, it becomes habitual and a little bit compulsive. But let's talk about the patent question, on which you've been very bold, and the ownership question. Who's setting direction? Who owns this science? I just looked again. You can see it on YouTube. Edward R. Murrow in the 1950s interviewing Jonas Salk. And he says to him very directly, who owns the patent on your polio vaccine? And Salk looks at him and says, well, I think the people. I mean, who else? And he said, who would patent the sun?
Everybody, right?
Yeah. A few thousand lawyers would be fighting over it. But how have we come to the point of tooth and nail battle, hundreds of lawyers and investors fighting over this miracle,
right?
CRISPR.
I mean, I don't think people appreciate the extent to which everything that happens in science these days is patented. You know, you make some new observation or new discovery, even if it only has imaginary potential uses, the pressure at universities these days is to patent it. And so it's no surprise that everybody who was involved in discovering the basic biology of CRISPR and starting to use it for editing DNA has filed patents on it, and especially because the potential profits here are immense. So
you're talking on a radio program called Open Source. We are open source people. We believe that phrases, musical ideas, architectural notions, they're all a kind of common stock.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, you know, I've been fighting to get the scientific literature free of its shackles for years, and I think, you know, we haven't faced this issue with patents, and I think we have to me the there's all the literature and ink has been spilled on the question of does CRISPR belong to Berkeley or does it belong to MIT, and it's exactly the wrong question. I mean, you know, CRISPR should belong to nobody, and you know,
yeah,
this is work.
We want to liberate Mickey Mouse from Walt Disney.
Yeah, you start with Mickey Mouse. It's all his fault. But,
right, but come to the real point here of who controls our future and who should own it, who's directing it, and who in the world is going to stand up for the people's interest, whatever that is.
So I think the deeper question here is not even whether this should belong to the public or not. I don't think it's that hard. I mean, the public funded this research. The public should own it. And the fact that that patents have been granted to Berkeley, to MIT, and to other people for something that was, you know, basically just drawn from biology, and more importantly, was discovered on the public dime, is ridiculous. I think that maybe the more interesting question is, what does it mean in a broader sense for the potential for the scientific community to use CRISPR in a productive way that's in the best interest of society, that pretty much all everybody's thinking about is who's going to make money from it. And mm-hmm. The fact that someone's going to get a patent on it is going to limit the way the technology is used, but it's also going to make people incredibly rich. And what worries me the most about it is, you know, first of all, the technology isn't going to be as widely used or as broadly accessible as it could be if it were just in the public domain where it belongs. But secondarily, I think we have to ask ourselves if a scientific community who's more interested in who's going to profit from a technology
right.
is really the right group of people to try to decide how such a tricky and complicated kind of technology is going to be used for the benefit of society.
Point taken, Michael Eisen. Come to the question of how you would regulate a race, set limits on what genes you can tweak and what you can't, what permanently, what today, but then also how you regulate a race that has China playing in it.
Yeah, the tricky thing is I'm not sure you really can regulate it. I think the history of trying to regulate science has been one in which the people passing the laws and trying to decide what you can and can't do are so hopelessly behind on the technology that they're just ineffective. And so I don't think the answer here is to try to put some kind of shackles on the science, not because I don't think that they should be there, but
even
in
affecting the germline of a species for all time.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen. I think we have to face that fact. And the question we should be asking is, what are we going to do with that? How are we preparing society for that future? Not are we going to step in and prevent people from doing it?
Michael Eisen, don't go away. We're talking about the CRISPR revolution, referred to generally now as the scientific breakthrough of the 21st century. Coming up, the prehistoric woolly mammoth, about to be brought back from extinction to a movie theater near you. We're talking with Ben Mezrich, whose gift is writing about huge lurking trends in our culture before they spring on us, like The Social Network and now CRISPR. This is Open Source. Will it be the screenwriter or the journalist who's going to tell us the CRISPR story that moves us and persuades us? We're listening to one of each. First, Ben Mezrich, who dreamed up the Social Network movie about the making of Facebook and all those IT billionaires. He's got a new blockbuster out in book form, soon to be a movie called Woolly, about the mammoth last seen as the Ice Age was melting down. The human hero of his story is the giant Harvard biologist who means to revive the woolly mammoth with its DNA and his own CRISPR tools. His name is George Church. In the movie, he's going to look something like Indiana Jones in Jurassic Park. Ben Mezrich, how do you spot these stories ahead of time in brief?
Yeah, I'm always searching for something to write about, and I've been obsessed with woolly mammoths since I was little, and I've also...
Really?
I love them, and I've always wanted to be Michael Crichton, and I've always been looking for my own Jurassic Park, and I started hearing about this story a couple of years ago, and the whole idea that there could one day be a woolly mammoth born in a lab 3 miles from where I live in Boston was just incredible to me. And so this is the first story I reached out to the main character. It's usually people pitching me stories. And I reached out to George, didn't know him at all, and he invited me into his lab.
But you knew the mammoth. You were charmed by the mammoth before you were charmed by George Church. I want to hear everything you can tell us about George Church.
I mean, he is a huge person, like you said, both physically and in personality. I think George is an amazing person. I call him the Einstein of our times. I think he's leading this revolution that's going on where we've gone from reading DNA to writing it. He's intense and he's brilliant. He's narcoleptic. Meaning he falls asleep in the middle of a conversation.
On you?
He falls asleep if he sits still. He has a disorder, but it doesn't affect him in a negative way. He's learned to work around it. He grew up dyslexic, raised by a single mother in the swamps of Tampa, Florida.
I was going to say, yeah.
Came out of that, but was so incredibly smart by seventh grade. his science teachers just handed him the keys to the labs and said, I can't teach you anymore because you're beyond us. Was, you know, one of the youngest people on the team that started the Human Genome Project, and now he's leading the revolution with CRISPR. But he's this very responsible, very ethical individual who, you know, he tells me that before any project he does, he writes the ethical paper first and then goes into
meaning,
the science
what
of
does
it.
That sound
meaning
like?
They discuss in detail, they go into the ethics of whatever it is they're going to do before they do it. Because they know these are big, big stories and big, big topics. And the technology, you know, can be used in a lot of different ways.
Can I just say, I've sat with the man last summer at some length, and he was very, very open to talking about all the issues. Mm-hmm. I have huge reservations, to put it mildly, about what he's doing and the technology, the idea of playing with our code. But everybody loves George Church.
Right.
Even Michael Eisen loves George Church. He doesn't love Eric Lander.
Right.
But Stephen Colbert loves George Church.
Right.
You trust George Church. You do feel there's an honest mind there. And as he said to me, you know, I think about Murphy's Law 24/7.
Right. And he does. And, you know, the thing about Church is that this technology is outside. You know, the Pandora's box is open. The technology is here. And the question is, who do you want to be leading this revolution? And when you meet George, he's the guy you want to be leading it.
No, he does seem like he was chosen to be the point man of a...
Right. I mean, the way he describes himself in my book is that he's a traveler from the future, that he sees himself
just gonna
as
ask.
Someone.
That's
right.
A key
he,
point.
He basically believes, you know, starting as a child, that he had come back from the future and his goal was to get us there.
He's bored by the present. Let's get there.
Let's get
he can
there.
See it in his head.
Right.
We're going to hear from his wife a little later, who says the same thing. It's a matter of projecting
right.
a dream forward and then catching
right.
up
and
with
his
it.
Optimism is incredibly infectious. I mean, he truly believes that, listen, we're going to cure all these diseases and we're going to solve our climate change problems and we're going to do it all using these tools in synthetic biology. He sees that as this...
His optimism gives me the willies, I got to tell you. Because I thought, what optimism? He also raised a question. People speak of the 21st century as the century of biology, as the 20th century of physics, bombs, quantum mechanics, the whole thing. I'm struck by the difference. All the old bomb scientists I knew, and I knew several of them, especially Philip Morrison at MIT, George Kistikowski, and others, they were gray, old, ruined men when I met them. The biologists are bubbly, cheerful, happy, healthy-looking guys with families, and they haven't experienced the damage they can do.
Well, I mean, I think that they're well aware of the dangers, but I think they look at it as, you know, they're going to cure disease. And when you look at it that way, it makes you positive. I think it makes you optimistic. And you look at these advances going on. I mean, the idea that we can get rid of malaria, you know, by fixing the mosquito.
But then what happens to the world of flowers and bugs and who knows what when all the mosquitoes are gone?
Well, you don't get rid of the mosquito. You just make them not able to carry malaria. You know, you make mice
Again,
that can't
effects,
carry Lyme disease.
We don't know the effects.
Well, yeah, you have to be careful. And there's no question about it.
I want to introduce another writer that you know, Ben. Mm-hmm. Antonio Regalado is a key journalist on the CRISPR beat, a minute-to-minute reporter, literally, online for the Tech Review, which is owned and managed by MIT. Among the levels of his CRISPR coverage are the science of it, the people who do it, their motivations, money, and the people who invest it, and more, the Silicon Valley connection.
There's a big influx of people from Silicon Valley into biology generally. Because if you think about it, what is bigger than computers? What is bigger than the field of software and computers? It's healthcare. I mean, healthcare is
right.
a third of the economy or something. And so a lot of them seem to see biology as a great new area to expand into. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, they bring along the record of their own success, and they also have a metaphor, which is code. You'll hear a lot that biology is code. It's just a code. It's as simple as a code. And so why can't we hack it? And so you have a lot of ambitious people saying, well, this looks really easy. We'll jump in. The biologists kind of react to this with a bit of a snicker because biology usually turns out to be not so easy.
Not only not easy, but who's to say, hold your damn horses. You're talking about a human species that's millions and millions of years old, untampered with by likes of you. What are you doing? What are you doing in this business?
They're getting involved. Google has a subsidiary that started to get in. I went there and they have a mosquito room. They're starting to engineer mosquitoes. Bill Gates, of course, is all over healthcare. And it is somewhat alarming to me because they want things to go, in general, faster, quicker. They can tend to, you know, break rules of the road. So that can be a little bit scary when you're thinking of dealing with biology. Like, I don't like to think about what Google would do if it unleashed its manpower and way of thinking on the biological world. I think it's going to happen. It is happening in small ways. And Amazon as well. Google and Amazon see that there's a lot of data being generated by biologists. In fact, it's some of the biggest big data that there is. And so Google has come in, as has Amazon, just with a kind of a cloud computing service. We'll store your genome. You know, for $25 a year, you can store a genome with us.
There's also a journalistic puzzle here for me. We live here actually almost in visual distance of Kendall Square, where so much of this work is concentrated, and we know virtually nothing about it. What were they really like in East Cambridge in 2017?
I think that scientists often have, in some ways, a conservative mindset. They might be quiet, they might be introverted. They typically come from more conventional backgrounds. How they get hooked into science, you know, the cliches, well, someone gave them a chemistry set. But I think it's true. You know, at some early point in their lives or careers, they get kind of hooked on the fact that there's a black box and nobody knows what's in it. And it's their curiosity often that drives them to do the work, but they're not really flamboyant characters. People are getting rich, I guess. I can tell because I can look up the S1 form of some new biotech and I can see how much shares they have. In the case of the CRISPR companies, the scientific founders, the amounts are large, $8 million, $10 million. And yet when I interact with the scientists themselves, George Church, for instance, with his sort of lumpy shoes, like, you know, does money motivate him? Is he wealthy? He doesn't act like it. So I think, you know, fundamentally, I got to believe that people are motivated by the fact that they're discovering stuff. And the glory in that is worth more than the money, but I might be naive.
I keep wondering, and I bet you do, sort of, when people wake up to the strides that are being taken, sort of on the species' behalf, is there a backlash coming? I keep wondering, what would Trump, let us say, at his worst, want to do with those pointy-headed people up in Cambridge who are playing with our nature?
Right. I've been trying to get it to Trump's attention. I've, you know, made some comments on Twitter, like, wouldn't it be nice if Fox and Friends could cover this embryo editing? Wouldn't that be terrific? Because then Trump would see it, and then he might make a comment. And actually, I got shushed by a couple of scientists. They said, shh, that could really cause trouble. You're playing with fire. But I can think back to the first term of George Bush. In his first 9 months, it was completely dominated by this question of the ethics of using embryonic stem cells. Until 9/11 happened, this was the issue that weighed so heavily on him. And I think that the proof that the conversation has changed is that this report that just came out from Oregon about gene editing embryos, they created 150 embryos for this research. And nobody made any comment whatsoever about that, even though it's certainly a record. In the state of Massachusetts, it's illegal. So it's not really part of the national conversation right now.
Xi Jinping calls, Regalado, do you know what we're doing?
Right. I think the big question is, what is China doing? China's been at the forefront, or is at the forefront, of a lot of these technologies of generating genetically modified animals. They had the first reports about editing human embryos, and it's very hard to know what is going on in China. And a lot of people have questions about, you know, does China bring a different morality to this question of genetically modified people? I mean, I don't know, because I don't know enough about China to say, but it'd be easy to fall into the trap of thinking that they value intelligence, maybe they value individual lives less, like maybe they would go ahead and try and make the super race. Like, this is a conversation that is happening. The former head of national security for the United States, James Clapper.
Yes.
He came out with, they have an annual intelligence estimate that they do that's public, and surprisingly, on the list of weapons of mass destruction,
right,
they put gene editing alongside Russian ballistic missiles and the North Korean nuclear program. They put CRISPR gene editing. And a lot of people said, well, this must mean the environmental consequences, like you could release some kind of mechanism into the environment to kill mosquitoes, and that's a risk. But the example that they gave was that the Chinese were editing embryos. that was the example that they gave. I should say, these reports out of China on the embryos were first greeted by U.S. scientists with alarm. People would say these were bad studies. They should not be published, as if it was something disgusting. But here we are 2 years later, and the same type of research is being celebrated on the cover of Nature. So in this case, we're catching up.
You said to me, you want to know what's going to happen in the human realm, watch the animal guys. What does one learn from the editing of animal genes, mice on up?
Right. Well, and also, the people who work in animal science have sort of practical aims. They have practical goals that they could achieve. And also, it's true that in embryology, people spend their time studying animal embryos, right? So I do go to the animal science people to kind of learn what is possible so that I can kind of try and get into position to see if that's happening in humans.
Hmm.
And this just gets very concrete. We had an important story on the whole notion that you could edit a human embryo in 2015. And the story starts with a vignette of me interviewing a researcher. And I asked the researcher about gene editing cattle, gene editing pigs, and then I finally got to my real question, well, can you do it to humans? And by that time, we were having a scientific conversation, and so the answer slipped out. So I said, of course we can.
Yeah.
Don't you know? We have just those plans. Let me show you.
Mm.
And that's where the story of, you know, the editing of human embryos broke out. It came directly from a line of questioning about what you could do to animals.
Antonio Regalado is the senior editor of MIT's Tech Review, focusing on biomedicine, not least on how technology is transforming science and healthcare, yours and mine. Michael Eisen in Berkeley, you're one of those animal guys with fruit flies. What does that work imply about the work ahead on humans? What does it tell you?
For the most part, what we learn when we mess around with the genomes of flies or other things is we just break things, right? We know we're really good at breaking a fly and making it not fly or not live or have some kind of odd colors. We don't really do a lot to try to improve them like we would a human. We don't try to treat diseases in flies or something like that. But I think it's really interesting. We've been messing around with the genomes of flies for decades. We've been doing it in bacteria and yeast and for most of my life.
Not to mention all those little boys at their desks, you know, pulling the wings off flies if they can catch them. Right. Go
ahead. Sure. it's somewhat remarkable the extent to which even though we've been playing God with flies and mice for decades, we really haven't looked at these questions as a scientific community. I think, you know, as Anthony points out, it's only very, very recently that we've had the capability of starting to do these things in humans. So, you know, I'd like to say we've learned a lot about what's going to happen in humans by what we've done in flies, but I think we just haven't really confronted the issue.
Well, have you adjusted to this rather amazing fact that the gateway is open to work with humans?
Yeah, you know, I think to be honest, the research community hasn't adjusted to it. There are people like George Church who are embracing it wholeheartedly, and I think the research community just kind of saying, well, cool, we can do this now. Let's go back to doing what we were doing before. I think people would be shocked the extent to which the research community has not wrestled with these issues in any meaningful way.
Well, George has. Funny, he's in the news again, big time, today for preparing piglets biologically to shed the chemistry in their organs that would be objected to if it were transplanted. In other words, there's always a problem of rejection, and he seems to have solved that problem. So it's amazing. The pig pieces, your liver or whatever, will be here in no time.
It's going to change everything. I mean, the idea that you can transplant from a pig and get rid of those lists of people waiting for kidneys and livers because you're going to have herds of pigs with human-compatible livers and human-compatible kidneys, I mean, it's going to be massively life-saving, and it's something, it's a spectacular moment. And this is something that was attempted before you know, to transplant using pigs and animals and never worked. And suddenly now, because of CRISPR, it can work.
I
want to get you both to speak to something Antonio Regalado spoke about, which is this latent, maybe populist, maybe religious or otherwise backlash coming against this whole thrust. Most people have never heard of it. But now, Michael Eisen, what's to be aware of there, or what's to be aware of?
I think the big test is, you know, does the research community deliver something that's incredibly useful before it does something that's, you know, really scary? I think, you know, nobody, I love what George is doing with a mammoth, but no one thinks their lives are going to get better if they have a mammoth in their backyard. Or maybe a few people do, but you know, if we start treating people's diseases and if you know, babies born with fatal illnesses are starting to be cured, I think there'll be the opposite of a backlash. I think there'll be a demand for the technology to expand. If instead, we release a mosquito that causes some unforeseen consequences, then I think the backlash is coming. So it's on us to determine what's going to happen with this.
Michael Eisen, stand by, and Ben Mezrich too. Coming up, breaking what seems like silence around science with historical and humanistic points of view. We're talking about CRISPR. This is Open Source. It's the tiniest fragment of the population that could explain the science of CRISPR, and I surely couldn't. And there are not many more people who have heard the human arguments about it. But there are agitated voices inside biology and outside it who want to be heard in this near silence, and we invited two of them to speak with us. Robert Pogue Harrison teaches literature at Stanford. But first, Ting Wu leads a genetic biology lab at the Harvard Medical School. She founded the Personal Genetics Education Program to fire up conversations in churches, for a start. And she is married to her most famous colleague, George Church, with whom she has had running debates morning and night for most of 30 years now. In her office this week, I asked her to draw some lines that she argues over with her husband.
I think I'm not a line drawer. I really believe that many of these decisions are personal choices. For example, some people think that hair color and eye color are cosmetic traits for an individual. But hair color, eye color, and skin color are also very connected to your safety, your welfare, how you're treated when you go into a hospital, your longevity. It's a health issue, too. So to say it's just a trivial trait that's not important maybe does not capture how we view each other, how we judge each other. Judgment is a very powerful way in which we affect each other, and these traits are used for judgment.
We're an old species, but we're just getting used to the fact that we're one. We're not different race to race or color to color or continent to continent. It's one history, it's one carburetor in every one of us, and they're basically the same. I wonder, you know, what's the risk of implanting fundamental differences, cancer-proof or not, tall or short, stronger, weaker, more intelligent, creating new classifications of people.
Is there a risk, is what you're asking?
Yeah, and of thinking of ourselves as different animals, different creations, different privileges, different entitlements.
We're on this very interesting threshold, which we've been on for hundreds of years in a way. With each invention that we make, we create different societies, different capabilities, different potentials. And I guess what people are focused on now is this is a change that goes into our genome.
Yes.
Although effectively, outwardly, it will be achieving what we have done through better industry, better agriculture.
Sure. Education.
Right. Imagine we're 500 years down the line. I think I hope that society will be happy that it exists. And it will exist because of whatever decision we make today.
Why?
Whether we say it's good or bad, the outcome is we're going to have a society that is going to be glad that it's there. So here we are trying to predict what that future society deserves. And I'm going to say, I think the answer to that is probably so wide and so diverse, we will not be able to corral ourselves into one answer. And the future society will be glad that one group of people didn't come up with an answer and force it on everyone else.
It's a fascinating premise, the idea that we start with a vision of a happy society, recognize that what we're doing today is going to help shape it, and then sort of reverse engineer the place we're trying to get.
I would say there are 7 billion people on this earth.
Yep.
I personally feel that if we can make sure all 7 billion at some time in their life knows what's going on, has a chance to think about it and debate it, that we will be in a safer place. Mm. I have a greater chance that we'll be satisfied with how we handle this.
It is sort of at the turn of the Renaissance, for example, that say 500 years ago, people thinking, aha, there's a new vision of man. Do we want to go that way? This will be remembered 500 years from now. What are we creating? What are the implications? Who are we leaving out, etc.?
Yes, yes. And I think, of course, today we know what happened then, and it's incorporated into our way of thinking. Our vista is quite big. We are facing both climate change, big issue, and people are thinking of traveling to other planets. We have very big issues to consider, and the definition of humanity and what our purpose and where our goal is quite impressive and daunting.
My question, I'd try to ask it with no judgment at all, but would be simply, why are we doing this? Why are we playing with our fundamentals?
I think one of the most remarkable things about human beings as a group is the desire to do something that makes life better or more interesting or more fair for everybody. And we just keep trying. Even some of our battles, our greatest wars, were to make things better. Human beings invent endlessly. Children invent endlessly to make things better. This is just one of the most fascinating things about human beings. And I think, by and large, really, almost overwhelmingly, we do it for good reasons. There are times when I say to George, I'm so proud to be a Homo sapien, is when I see moments where we really use our creativity to the best intentions. Makes you proud.
That was Dr. Ting Wu in her lab at the Harvard Medical Research Building on Avenue Louis Pasteur in the Fenway in Boston, across the street from the Boston Latin School. We know Robert Pogue Harrison as a humanities professor, a Dante specialist at Stanford, who podcasts on a great variety of civilized subjects. Earlier this summer, when the Templeton Foundation brought the superstars of CRISPR World to a weekend retreat in California, Robert Harrison was invited to sit in alongside George Church and Ting Wu of Harvard and Jennifer Doudna of Berkeley, and to speak for the long philosophical and moral view of a scientific revolution. On the phone this week, Professor Harrison told me he came away from that meeting more perturbed than when he went in.
As a humanist, I had been anticipating a charged, febrile, raw, you know, kind of embattled discussion. And I was expecting a lot more urgency among the participants than was actually the case, given the potentially overwhelming consequences of this new technology. And even what Jennifer Doudna, in the subtitle of her book, calls the unthinkable power to control evolution.
Yeah.
So I was a little puzzled, frankly, by the relative sanguinity, or let's say the dispassionate theoretical detachment of much of the discussion. My sense was that most of the people there felt, or at least pretended to feel, assured that as long as we all remain reasonable, as long as we all put our minds together and make informed decisions about CRISPR's use, that everything's going to be fine. I would have preferred more discussion of the potentially destructive and even catastrophic risks that such a technology introduces into the biosphere. I would have preferred that after the retreat, there would have been the articulation of a few core principles, maybe ethical or moral or philosophical principles, that would serve as a foundation for all future discussion of the technology. Those core principles, as far as I'm concerned, did not emerge. But what did emerge is a sense that all these issues that involve the science on the one hand, the technology and its uses on the other, the social and even political effects of it, there's a great deal of relativism, and you put enough people in a room and you appreciate the enormous complexity of everything that's involved, and we kind of muddle through a number of the issues, which I guess is good enough.
Isn't that E.M. Forster's line, that's what people do, is muddle through?
Yeah.
But this is science at a universal, radical, wildly unimaginable level. Do we muddle through this sort of thing?
I think we have no choice eventually but to muddle through it. But I think you're right to say it's unimaginable. What might be most in demand in this whole thing is a little bit more imagination.
What do they think are the real dangers, Robert?
The big concern was human enhancement. How do you think about it? Is it possible that within a few decades, maybe 10% of the human population will have tails? Not because they need them, but because they want them? Maybe, maybe not. What we do know for sure is that human desire is intrinsically polymorphous, and that when human desire and something like CRISPR technology are conjugated, we have to expect and imagine all sorts of otherwise unimaginable results.
What do you imagine, Robert? Either nightmare, or have you always wanted to have a tail?
No, I'm not one of those who would want to have a tail. On the other hand, I'm not one who wants to cover my body in tattoos either. But I do know that those who are willing to cover their bodies in tattoos may also find the possibility of having a tail appealing. What I find disturbing is something that Hannah Arendt already identified about 60 years ago when she wrote The Human Condition and warned against what she called acting into nature, by which she meant bringing about processes or results in the natural world that nature itself would never have brought about on its own. She was thinking particularly about nuclear fission and the atom bomb, but clearly gene editing is an even more extreme example of what it means to act into nature.
Robert, all the CRISPR talk is, as you say, enormously human-centric. There's other life on this planet, squirrels, orchids, tigers. Who's worrying about them?
Not many people were worried about other organisms, to tell you the truth.
Do you?
Yes, very much so. If the non-human biota of the Earth were capable of receiving the news of CRISPR's invention, and if it were capable of spreading the news and of rumor, the whole animal world would be in a state of sheer panic and on the edge of hysteria, and rightly so, because they have no reason to trust our intentions or our prudence, given the abysmal track record of our dealings with most other species. And here I would invoke something that St. Paul wrote in his letter to the Romans. I quote, "The whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time." And by this he meant that it's not only human beings, but the whole created world that is suffering or is kind of in need of some sort of redemption. But I think that if the creatures of the Earth could learn of our new gene editing capabilities, that groaning would get a whole lot louder right now.
There's a story in the story that I want you to elaborate, and it's Ulysses, the hero of the Trojan Wars, one of the great foundations of Western literature thinking. In Dante, and you're a Dante scholar, he's consigned to the eighth circle of hell for presumption at the end of his war career of heading west toward the Gibraltar Gate and telling his men, let's go. This is outer space, but we're going to do it. In Tennyson, he reappears in a famous poem as a hero again. He says, "For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die." Put Ulysses in this story. You know the Dante version. You know the Homer version. You know the Tennyson version.
Right.
I keep seeing George Church as a kind of Ulysses here.
Yes, you could say that there's something about the scientific age, which is Ulyssian, Dante's Ulysses, Dante's Ulysses is someone who reaches the Straits of Gibraltar, and at the Straits of Gibraltar, there's a warning. Do not go any further. It is forbidden territory, the unpeopled world. But Ulysses urges his men and uses his gift of rhetoric to persuade them into this self-overreaching journey into the unknown world. Mm. And Dante's story does not end well. It ends in tragedy. The funny thing is that Dante's Ulysses becomes the hero, the archetype of the age of discovery, the age of exploration, the age of scientific revolution. And he is still very much, as you mentioned in the Tennyson poem, this endless questing for ever new horizons right. of knowledge and of exploration and of discovery. You could say that CRISPR is one of the most recent exemplifications of something in our species, right. something innate in us, which refuses to accept limitation, and it's always testing the boundaries of what is possible, and especially in the realm of knowledge. And yes, in that sense, someone like George Church is a Ulyssesian figure. This thirst for the unlimited that continues to push our scientific endeavors and technological endeavors is out of touch with the fundamental mortality of this planet we live on, which gets smaller year by year. And if we want to continue being a heroic Ulysses type, that the challenge now that we have to face in the same heroic spirit is how to accept limitation and live within the finite boundaries of the biosphere on the one hand and human mortality on the other. Now, that would be a heroic challenge, and one that would lead away from disaster towards making ourselves at home on this planet of ours.
That was the Stanford literature man, Robert Pogue Harrison. Michael Eisen, Ben Mezrich, time running out. I just want to say, Ting Wu and Robert Harrison have very different angles, but I can tell you, she said, Robert Harrison was the most interesting performer at that seminar, and Robert Harrison said at one point to his friend, Jennifer Doudna, nothing personal, Jennifer, but if it were me, I'd heave that whole CRISPR thing into the Pacific Ocean. What do you make of their reservation?
Well, I'm much more optimistic. I want to live in a world where we do beat mortality and we live forever and we're surrounded by woolly mammoths. I want to be in that world, and so I see CRISPR as getting us there. I think that you know, these limitations that he's talking about are the things that CRISPR is aiming at. We don't have to be mortal. And, you know, the world doesn't have to end. And we can fix the environment. And we can also have woolly mammoths. And that's my optimism there, I think.
Michael Eisen, do you want to make a case that the planet dies without this intervention?
It dies without intervention. Whether, you know, we certainly have to do something. We have to engineer our planet in various ways, and I think part of that's going to be engineering species. I don't think we have to engineer humans to save the planet. But I, you know, when I listen to Ting and Robert, I what I am struck by is just the lack of imagination that biologists have about the chaos that this introduces into the universe. I think not about the kind of petty decisions you have to make. Is it okay for people to change their hair color or their eye color or even to give themselves tails? I think about, you know, what happens when internet trolls can edit the DNA of any species on Earth? You know, every technology that we create, even as it moves us forward in some way, it's surrounded by a cloud of chaos. And that chaos is what we should be afraid of. It's not rational actors, you know, doing sane things we disagree with, perhaps in a debating hall. It's the what happens to this technology when it's unleashed, and the internet trolls are a perfect example that we have no idea what these technologies do.
I hear you precisely, and I sympathize, Michael Eisen. I think you're voicing an anxiety. I hear it in Ting Wu too. I hear it in everybody, frankly, except George Church, about what the hell we're going to do here and the dangers. Thank you, Michael Eisen, Ben Mezrich, Robert Pogue Harrison, Ting Wu, and Antonio Regalado. Visit our website for more on CRISPR, including an interview with George Church. Our show this week was produced by Humans All, Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DeGregorio,
and Kevin Daugherty. Special thanks to Robert Trivers. Susan Coyne is our line drawer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive autopilot. I am Christopher Lydon, all natural in the flesh. Join us next time on Open Source.